Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Sabine and Keen.
QML. With guest co-host.
Woodcraft. LZPRST.
R Roll 1.
You went normal and I get nerdy.
Wow, the last time someone called me normal. Thanks, Becky. Welcome to Polycast episode 120. My name is Dan Q, and we are going to be joined by my fellow regular co-host, Makalua, and LZPRST, first-time guest co-host, another first-time guest co-host, Rob Zachary.
Good afternoon.
And a returning guest co-host, our Roller One.
Hi, people. Glad to be back.
So CYZ started a poll over on Civ Fanatics about what national wonder is second best compared to the National College. And there we've got Circus Maximus, Hermitage, Heroic Epic, Ironworks, National Epic, National Tragedy, and Oxford. Or also, I don't consider the National College to be the best national wonder.
Huh.
Yeah, I know, it's an option, an option.
Some radical stuff there.
There are actually two
yeah,
votes.
What are you thinking?
Those two people that voted that in the poll as well as other answers, that's just trolling.
Oh, so it was Phil and his apprentice?
The fact that this thread has a poll made absolutely no bearing on my choosing this thread whatsoever. I mean, I almost managed to say that without So, for some reason, Ironworks is winning by a wide margin. You know,
I don't get that. it kind of makes
maybe
sense.
Maybe it has something with the lack of hammers and so forth.
That's why.
There we go. I agree. After National College, Ironworks, yes. We're going to be talking about National College on its own afterwards here. So we'll come back to that. So Ironworks plus 8 production, must-have workshop in all of your cities. So, I mean, workshops themselves are giving you plus 15% production and plus 2 production. So obviously you want it in a city that has production potential. Well, you also get that plus 1 engineer slot on, I almost forgot. But that plus 8 production, my goodness sakes, when that time comes about, and we already talked about production issues in Civ 5, it's really hard to beat that one national after National College, regardless of what type of victory condition you're going to be. Those are kind of two that are really minimally situational that you might order them differently.
Yeah, you always need tech in production.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you could have National College, I mean, if you have the research to build the nukes, it's not going to help you if you can't actually build the nukes.
Yeah, that's the problem. It takes forever to build anything.
It's economy, really, here that allows you to, you know, a strong economy, you can buy, and compensate for that lack of production. But there are times you might like a city or two that actually has some production capabilities, and if you're building it in a city that's already a decent production city,
yeah,
that city can make up for, perhaps, some other cities that are focusing on money, woohoo, which is also a great benefit in any Civ 5 game.
Yeah, it's a bit more money focused than production focused.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but if you don't have good core production, I mean, I've tried really money focused strategies, and I'm always flabbergasted by just how much money, buying your way through the build tree just bankrupts you really depressingly quickly. So I'm always struggling to, you know, create those one or two industrial cities. And in Civilization V, that is more of a struggle. It's much harder to get those production centers where, you know, in previous Civs, there are always a couple cities that, you know, it was almost like the city was like a magic wand, right? Like, oh, I need this wonder. Click, you know, 15 turns. Great. But in Civilization V, it's really, you know, if you got a factory city, I mean, that's the treasure. So I think, I mean, to some extent, it's kind of an obvious question, because there are always two cities you're going to need to create for yourself in any Civ 5 game. One is the scientific utopia, and the other is, you know, the industrial center. And the, there are two wonders in the game that are tailor-made for amplifying the effect of specializing your cities in a way that will always be useful throughout the entire game.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, it really costs a lot of money in Civ 5 to be keep pushing through and buying things and upgrading units, which is why I like, okay, let's build the Ironworks, and now I will take the Big Ben Wonder, which has a reduction of 25% of gold purchases in all of your cities, regardless of what it is you're purchasing. Then you find yourself going down the commerce line, and you get to mercantilism, and there's another 25%, so now it's 50% less. But you need to be able to get that Big Ben Wonder, and that Ironworks will be able to help you do that.
Yeah. Big Ben.
That's it.
Yeah.
Let's say it 5 times fast. No, we won't do that. Our audience is welcome to do so, however. But what I found really interesting is after the Ironworks consideration, I'm looking at the results of the poll, which, based on percentage, then goes Hermitage, Oxford, Circus Maximus, National Treasury, Heroic Epic, and National Epic. I really can't agree with this list. I mean, true, it depends on what type of victory you're going for, and I'm a domination kind of guy.
Huh.
And I'm just looking at this and I'm thinking, no.
I wonder why.
Because I like others. Well, there's that. Also, I think there's actually a better order here. I'm not going to do a top any kind of list here. I know Mackie's really disappointed in particular.
Disappointed is not the word for it, but okay.
Mackie's just going to roll with it because she knows it's the path of least resistance. So, if I had to rank number three, generally speaking, I'm going to say Heroic Epic. This gives you all new units in your city, receive the morale promotion, plus 50% combat strength. And if you're putting that, you must have a barracks in all your cities, which barracks, I mean, that's an ancient building, so you're probably already building those anyway, or should be, particularly on the domination focus here. And if you end up putting the Heroic Epic, say, oh, I don't know, in perhaps a really heavy production city, you know, ones that have a workshop, maybe also had an Ironworks too, then you're going to be able to be producing units even out of that one city faster or just as fast as you can out of other cities, and those other cities can be focusing again back on that money thing. And not only are they producing these units faster, but they already have these promotions before they ever even engage in combat. And it's all units in the city receive the morale promotion, right? I mean, the barracks applies to the land units, but the morale promotion is all units. Wow.
Pretty good, and it's why it's, you know, specialized the city with production and, of course, the rack up with the armory and the heroic ethic and just in a production heavy city that just more or less produces nothing but units the entire game. But I don't know. I don't really feel a need for the units unless I'm being on the offensive. I mean, I can fend off the AI with very little, usually 3-1 easily. So, I never build that many units. I often skip the heroic epic just because I don't need that many units unless I'm trying to take over the world by force.
Yeah, see, I think with this poll we run into the issue of, so we've got two national wonders that everybody's going to need pretty much no matter what strategy you're running.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest, I mean, this is the purpose of the national wonder in general, right? I mean, they exist to advance certain lines of play.
Yeah.
And you know, when I looked at the lukewarm response to the heroic epic, all that says to me is, my God, there's a lot of pacifists who play this game.
Mm-hmm.
Because the heroic epic, you know, yeah, you absolutely don't need it until you desperately need it. You know,
and that's
kind of where that slots in, where usually I can manage to maintain peace if I really want to. I'll just, you know, figure a way out to buy out the AI.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I have to launch a war of aggression or if I'm suddenly attacked, the heroic epic is one of the first things to be built because that's going to enable me to prosecute the war so much more effectively than if I didn't have it. But a lot of people don't seem to see the value in that, and perhaps that's because they're cowards.
Whoa, well, you see, you talked about people being pacifists in the game. See, I would be surprised they're pacifists in the game because they're warmongers in real life, whereas I'm a warmonger in the game, but I'm like a pacifist in real life. So, the thing is, though, even if you're not on that domination track, even if you can have all of your cities to If you have at least some decent production city, because perhaps you're pushing the cultural buildings towards a cultural victory, for example, then you have an offensive defense that's that much stronger. Now, I'm not saying that you would rank it third, perhaps like I would. Now, I certainly wouldn't say that I'm going to build even. Well, I'm not sure I'm not going to be building all these natural wonders in any particular game. I mean, that's just not going to happen. Just like you don't want to say, all of my cities must have every type of building in the game. We've been over that.
Yeah.
Or that's just, you have to tailor it to what's particularly useful. But when you're talking about the biggest bang for your buck, whether you're offensively offensive or offensively defensive, it's just, it's difficult to argue to me prioritizing some of these other things over a heroic. But whatever tax you're doing, whatever victory condition you're going for, or at least you think you're going for, the sooner you build these, the better, because the cost goes up for all of these particular national wonders, the more cities you have in your particular empire. You want to target also what technologies you require in order to build these things, and then know what particular building you have to have in all of your cities in order to be able to, in fact, build this particular national wonder.
Yeah.
So I guess we can continue going on my ranking, because I always love it when the topic is about me somehow. But also because I think it's in the conversation flow. Number four, when you are on the warmongering path and you're capturing cities, even if you don't annex them, for some reason people are unhappy about their city being taken over by a civ that wasn't theirs. I mean, I don't know really what that's about, because I was never talking about real life. But no doubt you are acquiring new luxury resources as a result, and that's increasing the happiness in your empire. But for me, where happiness is always an issue, and I'm not saying, it's one unhappy, I don't want to get to that 10 unhappy, because now my ability to construct units is also limited, but my existing units, there's that combat penalty. Oh my gosh, so I can't war as well as I was able to before, and perhaps even now defend myself now that I've taken some territory, and perhaps some AIs are now thinking, you're a warmongering menace, and maybe I've got more people declaring on me. Circus Maximus. You need Colosseums in all of your cities, but that is a classical building. You're going having a really particularly large empire. You've got to manage that happiness. You've got to manage that particular growth. I mean, in Civilization IV, it's trying to stay ahead of not having enough income, and then going into strike issues, whereas for Civilization V, it's keeping all the smiley faces.
Yeah.
You get +5 happiness, that's the equivalent of another luxury resource. It requires Colosseums in all cities, but if you're going down the track, like I'm saying, you probably have Colosseums in most, if not all, of your cities, either because you built them in really strong production cities, or you've got some decent gold cities, and you bought a Colosseum, which is like, 300-some-odd gold. And Circus Maximum, it comes at construction, which is a relatively early tech.
Well, I mean, the happiness is always useful. You need every bit of it you can get, at least the way I play. I mean, you build a few cities, and then you take a few colonies, and then you start growing them in size, and then you need those damn resources. So, yeah, get the magic circus going sooner or later, at least.
Certainly the Circus Maximum and the Heroic Epic are not huge like the National College and the Ironworks can be, but as has been pointed out here in the chat, I imagine, but I can't ask, and I will ask.
Well, technically another 5 population, that's what translates to.
That too, able to help your white empire become a little bit more of a tall empire, and you need that population.
Yeah.
And so you don't want too much, because now there's a happiness issue, and you can limit growth by managing the city, but you want to be able to actually make use of your items.
Yeah, exactly. I much prefer a tall empire to broad a flat one, but I'm not sure. It's more viable now than it was before the patch, but it's still not ideal, I'd say.
I feel for you, Tall Empire. Preferables. Preferables. There, I mean, I preferred you. Preferentials. You're in here, first on Polycast. Word of the year. And somewhere, some of my English teachers are crying.
All of them. All English kids in Canada are crying now.
So what would I put at number five? Well, I think particularly if you don't have a lot of cities that aren't around rivers, perhaps you know where I'm going with this, your national treasury, plus 8 gold, plus 1 sir, you need a market in all of your cities, which is a medieval building, and a market, even if you're thinking, well, it's not a particularly strong gold city, you do get plus 2 gold. Each turn from a market. And again, I'm not saying now build a market in all of your cities because you get plus 2 gold. But again, costs going up for each one of these national wonders the farther you go along in your empire. But particularly when you're starting out, it's coming early enough that you can be getting either building or purchasing markets in all your cities.
Yeah.
That plus 8 gold is helpful. I think it's more so, again, if you're not having a lot of river cities, but now we're talking about 5, 6, 7, 8. Now we're kind of in the latter half. These are even more situational, but I really do like the shines.
Such a shock. Dan likes shiny things? Who knew?
Well, if you didn't know me, you wouldn't know.
Oh, that's something.
The whole internet knows you.
That's deep.
The thing is, with national wonders in general, I mean, you kind of just want to get them eventually. And if you're building stuff in your cities, I mean, you pretty much, well, I as a, you know, builder of a tall empire with, what, 6 cities on a standard map or something like that, it's not easy to just get all the things you need and build all the national wonders anyway. I don't feel that really they're situational enough that I say, like, okay, this game I'm going to not get that one, this game I'm definitely going to. It's more like, yeah, I'll just build them eventually anyway. I really do feel that the game doesn't quite make me care enough about these things. I don't feel that the strategic decisions are heavy enough, so to speak.
I've got to believe things like national wonders and pretty well anything that you do, I found the more I've been going up in difficulty level, the more I'm paying attention to, it's not that I need this, per se, but it's going to give me an advantage down my particular victory path, which I mentioned before, and I'll mention again, is domination.
Yeah.
Well, that's the nature of Civ. Like, you know, in the lower difficulty levels, you don't have to make any choices. I think this is where the whole, like, you know, every city should have everything, you know, idea comes from. You're just not playing a hard enough difficulty level because that only works if, you know, you're basically, you know, doing bumper bowling with civilization.
You're bored.
Yeah.
So I mean, every time you turn up the difficulty, the choices become much more acute. There are more, you know, wedge issues, coming into play. Where, you know, okay, when are you going to do this expansion? You know, because that's going to change when you can get these national wonders. How far are you going to expand? So I mean, you know, every time you turn up civilization, you have to pay more attention to everything because now these choices, there's much less margin for error. There's much less room to feel your way through it, and that's when I think a lot of the special purpose of these national wonders and how the world wonders. That's when it really becomes clear, how important they are to a particular victory path toward victory.
I'd say emperor level, and as I said, I don't feel that the decisions are that cutthroat.
What game speed do you play at? Because when I think of difficulty level, I'm thinking, yes, difficulty level, but also game speed. Like, if you're increasing the game speed, that, to me, that makes it more difficult because you're advancing through the eras more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the time that you have to make those decisions, it's pushing more towards either, you know, winning the jackpot or going bankrupt.
Yeah.
Not to that extreme, but it's kind of on that scale.
I usually play standard speed now, of course.
When I play Civ 5, I'm typically the difficulty level below Emperor at King, but I'm playing on quick speed.
Okay.
And the fact that it's called quick is just an added bonus. But got here on number 6 here, Oxford University, 1 free technology, plus 1 culture. You need a university in all of your cities. Which is a medieval tech, with the education tech being the specific name. There's not a university technology, just in case anybody was confusing anybody. The one free tech, it can be situational. The one free tech, if you time it well, can be amazing. I really like the one free tech early on when you go down Liberty in Civ 5, you get meritocracy, you get that free great person, you choose a great scientist, and hey, if you've got metal casting ready to go, then boom, steel, assuming you have iron resources, of course, then away you with your long sources. But to me, the one free tech is nice, but I find it even more situational than some of the other ones here. And having a university in all of your cities, actually the smaller the empire you have, that seems to be a more advantage to me because the cost isn't as high and you don't have as many cities to build the university in. And you could be one tech closer to trying to thwart domination bastards such as myself.
Yeah.
National Epic at number 7 of 8 of National Wonders, plus 25% great people in the city. Yes, it only requires a monument in your cities, which is an ancient building. You probably have a lot of those. But unless you have a particular city that is perhaps has a wonder in it, that really is a really situational one. And then Hermitage is number 8.
Mm-hmm.
I really like this in Civ 4, but not as much in Civ 5 at all. Yeah, double culture output, but you gotta have a museum in all of your cities,
yeah.
Which themselves require an opera house. Mm-hmm. And then archaeology tech, it's like, whoa, no. Advanced start, okay, this changes a lot of these considerations, of course, and if you're going for a cultural victory, well, all the more power to you, but I just generally shake my head at that one.
No, I do prefer, I do feel that basically culture is too much of a hassle. There's not enough production to get those cultural buildings going, and unless you're going for that kind of victory. So I would say that Hermitage is cute. You can build it, but it's not that useful.
Then we're just going to briefly talk about the National College, because you've mentioned it already. And what this does is it increases your science output by 50% in addition to plus 5 science. You need a library in all of your cities. Which, of course, a library is giving you plus 1 science for every 2 citizens in the city. Very important building in and of itself. And a common tactic, of course, is to put your capital to get the library in there once you have, what's the name of the technology writing there? I had to think about that for a moment. And then as soon as you have your library or your paper maker, if you're China, to go get the National College. And the fact that you get that plus 50%, it's not just the plus 5 science, it's really helpful in the early game, but it's almost certainly going to be that your capital is your best science city, or certainly one of your best science cities, and you've got that plus 50% throughout the entire game, whatever victory condition, although also maybe whatever difficulty in some respects, but certainly whatever victory condition you're going for, wow, and I'm not saying always start with the National College. You got to take your situation into account. But as far as the best national wonder goes, oh my, I'm going to write it some love letters right now.
Well, yeah, that's pretty good. And you get it early. And that 5 science early is a lot. And then 50% on top of that, I mean, wow. I hadn't really paid that much attention, but I built it and it was like, I think it's doubled my tech in the early. I had 2 cities and I built that and it doubled it, I think, in my capital. So yeah, Nash College killed.
John, did I hear this right that you tend to run a small empire? Did I get that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, doesn't that also make? I mean, if you're saying you don't see the distinctions, or at least you don't feel the choices are quite as important with the national wonders. I mean, I think if you're running a smaller empire, that's very much the case. The nice thing about, the nature of a lot of these is the bigger you get, the harder it is to pursue these different lines. Mm-hmm. But if you're running a small empire,
yeah.
The whole game is geared around narrow but deep. I think if you're running a smaller empire, yeah, this decision will naturally be easier because that's what enables small empires to flourish in civilization.
Yeah, priorities or you know, go in a niche kind of thing. That's what you mean, right? No?
No. I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying a prayer that one day you will see the advantage of light empire over a tall empire. And
smaller empire, faster turns. Yay! Negative.
An empire is like small.
Power. Land is power, isn't it, then?
Yes, it is.
Hang on, because I'm sorry, I kind of want to get into this now, because I'm interested to see the clash of philosophies here, because Civilization V, for me, is the first civilization that really does reward not expanding. There are a lot of cool ways to win by, you know, operating a tiny, minuscule little empire. And this is one of my frustrations with Civ 5 is I feel like I have to really struggle to have the kind of world-spanning empire I've enjoyed in previous civilizations. So I'd be curious to hear you get into what are the advantages, Dan, because it might make for a more interesting game, perhaps a more demanding game, but advantages, I think, is a bit of a stretch. I've never felt like, you know, unless you can actually pull off the domination victory, I've never felt like having a far-flung empire has really rewarded me in the game.
You know, it's even more exciting. Okay, that's great. First off, I agree that if you're looking for a smaller empire, Civilization V is really helping you out as compared to most other Civ titles. A big thing when it comes to domination for me in Civilization V as compared to Civilization IV is a page that Civilization V borrows from Civilization Revolution. And that comes in when in Civilization IV, if you wanted to win, there's the domination and the conquest, and that domination you had to have such a percentage of both the population and the land.
Yeah.
And the land was like, oh my word. Mm. Okay, 0.5% closer. I'm 0.25% closer. I'm 0.5% closer. Are you kidding me?
Just one more tile.
But in Civilization V, you take out all of your opponent's capitals, you win.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually Civilization V in that respect is helping towards domination. We got rid of this conquest domination distinction, and now it's just called domination.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it also helps those looking for the smaller empires. Those going for, well, culture victory, I still think is pretty darn difficult in Civ 5.
Yeah.
We're going to exclude a time victory because that's a cop out. This editorial brought to you by. But as far as like a spaceship or a diplomacy win, absolutely. And I mean, sure, you can go for a cultural one too. I mean, you know, you just have to bang your head maybe a little bit less against the wall in Civilization V as compared to some other ships. And however, thinking about banging their head against the wall and how much that would hurt. Or maybe you were thinking about what it was Dan's head.
That's hurting my mind, Dan.
That's because we're on the same wavelength.
Get off my wavelength.
I'm not getting off of our wavelength.
Come on, I'm there first.
But just to interject here, I still don't feel you've made a case for running a large empire. Because what you described here, you're basically taking out hits on enemy capitals. That's totally different than, you know, having a huge empire. That's a different kettle of fish.
Well, I mean, as far as I'm talking victories specifically. Now, as far as managing a particularly large empire, when you're taking cities. Back, for instance, I can leave them as puppets, for example. Sure, I don't have to emphasize particular control over those things, and I don't get to choose what they're doing, but they manage economy very well. I've been finding that if I go into a city, for instance, if I'm capturing those cities and they stay my puppets, they can become my economic powerhouse. If I go in and start changing those cities, particularly those that are going to be puppets on a river where I've got a trading post bonus already, like there's already an inherent gold production, and then whatever technology down in the tree increases trading post output by plus one at the vote mid-game. I'm sure Madden can help out with that in the chat what that technology is.
It's a social policy, not a tech.
I'm sure there was also a technology that increases the trade.
I think there is, but it's so down the hill that I think we don't remember.
Okay, but in any event, that those cities that I'm taking over can become my economic base. And so now that I have that many more cities, and we know how strong economy is in Civ 5 and being able to buy what it is between buildings and units, and maybe even also influencing some city-states, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm thinking, I'm really hurting myself as far as culture by really building this white empire, I'm building more cities, I'm not able, cultural cost, number of turns it's going to take to, is increasing, and yes, I know that there's some wonders that I could build to combat that, just like anything, but let's say I'm not doing that, I'm just expanding, I'm taking over land. At a certain point, because I know I only have to now take out the capital in order to win the game,
mm-hmm.
quote unquote, officially win the game, because I think if you just take a capital and you continue to play afterwards,
mm-hmm.
that could be like a different circumstance if you really want to continue wiping them out. But I've gotten in situations where at some point, because of that large empire, that large economic base, I was able to, even though it was really farther down along the technology tree, it took me a little longer. There was nothing like being able to take six turns by myself, a giant death robot, take it across the water with a naval escort, and it just so also happened that their capital happened to be on the coast.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm taking your capital now.
I'm not saying that a small empire can't win. I'm saying that when it comes to a very large empire, Civ 5 is even more attractive than Civilization 4.
Yeah, I agree, actually. But that's kind of one of my beefs with Civ 5, is that it's really, as it was originally when it came out, it was just ridiculous to run a small empire at all. And I prefer that because I like to develop kind of the flavor of my empire to focus on a certain thing, either go all production to have or more just tech or trade or money and stuff like that. And the social policies in Civ 5, I like them. I think they're really cool for that. But I think they come too rarely in any game, unless you're actually going for those kind of cultural thing. And still then, take forever to get them. And they're the only real decisions I feel I'm making in the game. So, I might just be playing it wrong. I should be going around killing people and. But I always thought that Civ was more of a builder game than a war game. And I don't feel that the building part of it is adequately handled for me to kind of, enjoy it as much as I'd like.
I think you're playing Civ wrong. Anybody who says you're playing Civ wrong, you're doing this wrong. It depends on maybe you're doing it wrong or not as well for what it is that you want to do.
Mm.
I'm definitely not going to be one of those that says, you really should be going for this type of victory condition. And Madden is right that a lot of the advantages I've been talking about have been about domination versus expansion.
Mm.
He points out, generating great people, expand, and build one per city. When you're expanding, and you're taking that land yourself, either because you're building new cities,
mm-hmm.
or you're also taking over other cities.
Yes.
Either you're taking over that city, maybe you do want to annex that particular city you take over because it is such a production powerhouse and you want that direct control. Or this is going to be a real economic-focused city, I'm going to take that and let's stay a puppet and change over its improvements so it actually increases the economy to help boost that, to be able to have more, even more cities and more units and a bigger empire. And you can also get the choice in the larger empire. You can also choose to raise cities, even if it's, I don't make use of this, but they can make use of it, but I want to deny them that.
Mm-hmm.
And their also ability to do what they want to do, be it a cultural victory or a diplomatic victory,
mm-hmm.
is lessened. I'm not saying they're not going to be able to do it, but it's just going to take them more time. to be able to do that. If I am running amok and I am able to, you know, back my words with X weapons, it doesn't have to be nuclear weapons, and I have sufficient firepower, then that's the strength of an expansion and domination focus over others. And I'm not saying the others aren't viable. They are. The others can be enjoyable. And I have tried other victory conditions. Sometimes, what do you think you're going to be doing? Oh, crap. You do need to be adaptable.
Mm.
But I find that if at the very least, I think we can all agree that at the very least, even if you're not going for an expansion, a domination victory, you need to be able to defend yourself. Now, that does not simply mean that you need to have the units to do so. Either you're going with AI to help protect you, formal AI to help protect you, I think you're better off to be befriending some militaristic city-states actually to be gifting you some.
Yeah. But the thing is, I consider building a flat empire as one possible strategy. And I would like for it to be kind of one alternative, and the other alternatives would be choosing a small empire, but focusing on, for example, science, or for example, trade, or for example, tech to a larger extent. Now it's a bit more, it's all kind of, to me, it feels a bit bland. A lot of running a tall empire is, well, you'll end up building everything in most cities. You focus a little here and a little there, but I don't know. I'm just building a huge empire, and it's just fighting and fighting and fighting. And I'm sure that's all right, but I really get bored with it, especially since the AI is about as threatening as an imbecile with a fork.
I'll Serve You is really upset because his advanced units are taking one damage from less advanced units. So he's got, how can a barbarian brute damage a jet fighter? How can an archer damage a mech? And so he's advocating, I'll Serve You is not a gendered name, but he's advocating removing this minimum damage. And what I found interesting, hilarious, is that half the discussion goes in the direction of realism, where an F-22 fighter should not be vulnerable to an archer. There should be no damage. And then the other half of the discussion is gameplay.
I couldn't know it's spearman versus tech discussion, basically.
See, the barbarian brute can throw a rock that goes into the jet exhaust and causes it to damage the jet engine. There's your one damage. The archer against the mech hit a hydraulic line. Makes the legs a little wonky. One damage. You can explain these things.
Well, interesting historical fact. When Italy invaded Ethiopia interwar era? No. When the hell was
it? It was the first invasion or the second? The first one, it was in the 19th century. The second one was in 1946.
Yeah, at the end of the 19th century, like 1890-something like that, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it was shortly after they became a country, and they went out to get some colonies and decided to attack Ethiopia and take, well, Ethiopia. And the Ethiopian spearmen, actually, against Italian, more advanced stuff, they would just, with their hands, tear off, mechanical things that were working and ruin them. So the Italians actually got their asses handed to them in that war. It's theoretically possible, but I mean, that's the exception rather than the rule. I mean, look at, if we're talking realism, of course, I mean, you can go to certain British conflicts in Africa, you know, where the general rule...
Boer War, anybody?
well, I mean, that wasn't really against...
That was the barbarians,
Those were civilized people with rifles.
Yes.
Who knew how to use them. I mean, consider the colonial adventures, right? I mean, basically, as described by Blackadder, you know, taking huge vast tracts of land from people who were armed to their teeth with mangoes and kiwis. it's not exactly a fair fight. And in those cases, I mean, the Britons had, like, you know, 20 casualties, and the African kingdoms who fought against them had 50,000 or something during the whole war. So they had a saying, it was, whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun, and they have not. And it kind of describes how superior they were militarily. They didn't get hurt. They didn't get loose troops. So, I mean, they lost a lot, actually, to... attrition. I mean, they lost more soldiers from disease and desertion and these kind of things than they did from actual combat. And that's always been interesting with this series. They have no mechanism for, you know, stuff such as attrition and difficult terrain or temperatures and such.
Yeah, because you could be Germany trying to go into Russia in the winter.
Yep.
You're not going to lose it necessarily from actual fighting, but from the winter itself.
Yeah. And that same with Napoleon, and I mean, that's the reason why Africa wasn't colonized until the 1880s. It was because they didn't have the medicine to kind of keep people alive down there. And the same with the Amazon and the rainforest. And I don't think that's mirrored very well. They tried in 1954 with the unhealthy nuts from jungles. But in 1955, they got completely away from it. Now jungles are basically grasslands, and it kind of makes, it brings me to another issue I haven't seen, but it's the complete lack of flavor in the terrain. But I'm not going to rile on that now. But
not again.
Sorry, things you could argue for and against the plus one, or the one damage per attack thing. And I read the thread, some said that was basically attrition, right? It's basically, you know, friendly fire, whatever you want to call it, it stuff breaks. That's the one damage. Right? The mechanical army goes.
You got a flat tire on something.
Yeah. Or, you know, the steam engine and the engine got loose, or whatever.
Or you got out of coffee and your soldiers don't want to fight.
See?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. What I find so funny about this is, with Civilization, it's a game that lends itself to debates over what is and isn't realistic, but at the same time, that's also completely preposterous because it's such an abstraction, and there's so many things that are left undefined. I mean, what is a jet fighter in Civilization? What is a rifleman? Like, what are they really? Like, are we going to say rifle division? Is it a squadron of fighters? And then what is the act of conquest? You bash into a city until there's nothing left to stop you and your troops enter it. Yeah. So what is it representing there about the act of occupying and subjugating another people? So when you say like, well, what is this damage? How is it, you know, how is it, what does damage even mean in this context?
Yeah.
You know, it's from a realistic standpoint, you know, none of this stuff, you can always make a case for anything being realistic or unrealistic in Civ because it's all, it's all historical license, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's always a little bit funny to me. And the other thing that sort of jumped out at me in this thread is, in what cases is this one point of damage going to become relevant to you? Like, how often is that ever going to matter? Well, it's going to matter if you're down to one hit point and you're still trying to blitz through a weakened empire, you know, a backwards empire.
Yeah.
At which point my response is, buddy, if you don't like it, all you have to do is sit back for a turn and bring up a fresh unit or bring up somebody or let your units heal. What seems to be the root of this annoyance isn't just that it's unrealistic, but that it prevents you from basically hurling stealth bombers like lightning bolts from Mount Olympus on the primitives, you know, who you want to crush. And my response there is, well, this is a small nod to balance, to prevent you from, you know, basically like being the Europeans discovering the Aztecs and saying, well, you know, this empire is going to be gone in 5 minutes because we've got the tech. And that's just not how that's not how it works historically, but it's also not really how it should work in a game because you're going to have points where someone's going to get a huge advantage just because they found somebody who was so backwards and weak that they were able to double the size of the empire in, what, the space of a couple turns because they had they had the right unit matchups. It just seems seems unsatisfying.
Yes and no, but well, again, realistically, I mean that is realistic. I mean the Spanish and the Aztecs and Spain and South America, they just took it all, right? There were people there, but they just took it all. And the same with the English and later the Americans in North America, they just took it all because they could. They had the technology. It worked out well for them. It was a piece of tech. But gameplay wise, that's what we should be talking about. Yeah, as you say, I mean it doesn't really slow you down that much unless you're fighting a war with three units and you plan to take over a big primitive tribe or something. Then yeah. But then you should have just built more units.
And I think historically, and I'm playing Civilization 1, so I got it. No, it's not quite 20 years yet, but it's closer to 20 years than 15. Gosh, it's making me feel old. But anyway, it was nothing feeling like I have this incredible army, and let's say it's swordsman.
Mm.
Excellent, I got swordsman, I'm going to keep on going, I find out that my neighbor is ahead of me technologically,
mm-hmm.
It was in the Civilization 4 context, actually.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you here. I've got swordsman, and they've got macemen. And it's like, a crap.
Yeah, you're screwed.
You're screwed, because you are behind the tech. And it's now, wait a minute. Let's have a look at, let's compare your armies, which, and this is also a tangent why it can be easier in Civilization 4 to figure out exactly where you are as compared to another person in terms of number of soldiers.
Mm.
But anyway, you need to take that into account, because maybe they are ahead in technology, but they don't have the numbers to support that. So in Civilization 5, it was already being gotten at as far as the gameplay goes. If you have a sufficient number of lower tech units, you can either not only defend yourself against an onslaught of more modern units, but not as many, but you could also turn the tide and actually take out a city or two of theirs. So you're not only, there's maybe a penalty for you for not being as far down the technology tree, but you have more of what you have. And in Civilization 5, when you have the one unit per tile consideration, and you can't have these large stacks,
yeah. You
now have the carpet of doom instead of the stack of doom. So the minimum one hit damage as far as the gameplay goes as kind of a balance to the steamroll that was we were talking about earlier with the nostalgia even of Civilization 1, just get a few tanks or whatever and go steamroll this other civilization and use your tech advantage completely, just obliterate them.
Mm-hmm.
Very strong arguments on both sides. One person said, SW Manic said that because it's a game, it's not a valid response to any of these questions. Having rules for the sake of rules is stupid. I agree that having rules for the sake of rules is stupid, but this minus one, this at least one damage, is not. There's the realism argument, which is great if it works, and if it doesn't, it all goes back to the gameplay. You want to have the feeling that even if someone is behind, that there is a hope, that it's not, well, I might as well end the game now, because
yeah. What's
going to happen is predetermined. I can predict what's going to happen in 10 turns, I can predict what's going to happen in 100 turns, and I'm dead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, it's like chess, and if you really, really analyze it down to the absolute, I mean, you know, computer analysis, then white has a slight advantage. And if perfect players play, white will win every time. Luckily, people aren't perfect, and chess is interesting. But instead, that's the same thing. Once you get to a certain point where the AI has a certain advantage, it's like, another player has a certain advantage, it's like, I should just quit now because there's no way I can win because they have an advantage. And I suppose, detracting a bit from the top dogs is good because it makes the game more interesting for those who are at the mid-level. So, yeah, gameplay-wise, I think it's actually quite a sensible thing.
Skunhawk phrases it as this question. Does minimum damage rule add flavor to the game and make it more challenging, or does it make it annoying and boring? Well, I don't know if that they're necessarily mutually exclusive, because depending upon the side that you're on, it could be both annoying and also challenging.
Mm.
Oh, this is annoying because I can't just quite steamroll, so I need to do a little more planning in advance of going to war, if I'm going to continue the war, or I just know that the war is going to take me a little bit longer. And if I'm on the other side, yeah, this is also annoying, but it's also a challenge for me, if not to push and try to get my technology back up, then how is my production? Maybe I can produce more, I'm not going to say crappier units, but
less advanced. Less advanced.
Less advanced, thank
see we're trying to promote the editorialization here. Less advanced units, and it is actually possible, especially with promotions for also for earlier age units to be just as good, if not better, than fresh newer age units. So,
sure, you can just spam simpler units and toss them into the meat grinder, and it'll work. Yeah. It works even in RTSs. So.
Yeah.
And above all, I've already mentioned that. I mean, in a lot of cases, it's really not going to make the difference between we've got at least one damage, so now forget about war or forget about defense. It's just it's going to change the timeline, and it's also going to change what you are doing in the timeline, whether you are the person who is ahead in tech, not ahead in tech, has more units, doesn't have as many units, and you go from there. So this I'll serve you, as Rob pointed out, serves the trade. He thinks that he should remove this minimum damage. No, I mean, there's actually some suggestions in here about modifying this. Jag Beak Tiger Sif says perhaps Sif should have 100% hit points and damage based on percent. Same with so many other modifiers throughout the Sif series based upon percents. Well, now perhaps maybe that, well, I think if you got into percents, then if you're talking about a later game unit, more modern one, that would actually be to your advantage. So I'm not so certain about that. But getting rid of it, I don't think so. I think having the one, at least the one damage, serves for both the realism argument, which to me is bonus, which is, okay, that's nice, but I don't need it. But as far as gameplay goes, is there a reason? Yes, there is. And you know what? I think it makes either the person who is thinking they're screwed because of being farther behind in tech, or the person farther ahead in tech thinking they're better, it makes both of you better players. Because you're having to think about the consequences and thinking about the other side. It's not just all linear crushify or all linear, I guess, if they're digging my own grave. Where's the show?
I have a club. I win!
You lose!
Pretty much. That reminds me one episode of The Simpsons that Lisa wished upon a star that for the world to get in peace and whatever, with the stuff. And in the end, they were disarmed and whatever. And in the end, an alien with a club invaded the Earth and just said exactly that line. I have a club, you, and whatever. That's fine.
Oh, right. I'm trying to think of the aliens' names. Well, I say Kronos doesn't sound right. Clang and or Clag or...
Or something like that. It was in season whatever about 10 years ago.
Yeah, when it comes to The Simpsons, for any situation in real life or in games, you could probably say Simpsons episode for that.
Yep.
Well, there's a South Park episode for that. With The Simpsons.
Yeah, actually they are.
Yeah.
Maybe just as a final point on the topic, it's kind of interesting going through the seven pages of the back and forth and the back and forth and the realism and the gameplay.
Yeah.
And one person, Elwin00, says, don't forget about friendly fire. And I'm like, whoa.
Wow, yeah, it does happen.
One nervous guy, a little twitchy, pulls the trigger too soon.
Yeah, not to mention tactical incompetence. I mean, oh my. If you read the story of the Charge of the Light Brigade, that is some of the most incompetent military tactics in world history. Of course, by the glorious British and their wonderful, tradition of choosing generals based not on skill, but on, breeding. Inbreeding, actually,
That was my point of bad breeding.
Yeah. It's not just, it's interesting, Breeding.
Yeah. That could lead to unfortunate situations. We have a military advantage. They have guns. They have swords. Okay, so the barrel line, we point that towards your face, right?
Yeah.
All right, goes for the other guy.
I don't know if anyone's played the Paradox series, like Europa Universalis or something like that.
It is.
Yeah. They have some really good things that I like. For example, that depending on how many wars you fight, you build military tradition. And that, I think they should kind of include instead. You have it with the great generals, but the great generals, they pop off and you use them for a while and then you
you know, don't use them for a while or whatever. But in for example, Europe and the Solid, you constantly have this military tradition percentage, which gives a bonus to just about everything you do in military. And I suppose that choosing the type of society you have should give kind of pluses and bonuses to that. For example, if you choose a meritocracy, I think your generals and have high military tradition, your generals should be strong and clever and stuff like that. But if you have no military tradition, then, you know, you won't get
your army is run by incompetent dungeons.
But doesn't Civ already kind of have that? I mean, it's not handled that way at all, but it's represented by having veteran units that have been, I mean, if you want to play this way and you don't, you know, disband your units when you're done with them, you keep your veterans around.
Yeah, but maybe for every X amount of turns that you've spent being in a war, maybe that's an extra experience point on a new unit, because they have these veterans teaching them.
Exactly.
They have the examples in textbooks.
This
is how we did this tactic.
Sorry, Maggie, did you say after so many turns in war? Is that how you phrased it?
Yes.
Well, that could be abused. So it would have to be.
Well, yes.
All
I'm thinking is let's declare war against the civilization on the other side of the planet and not do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you'd have to think of a way to make sure it was an active war somehow, not one of these paper wars that we get into.
Oh, Mac, you're killing my buzz, man.
Yeah, I'm a buzz kill. Hell yeah, I'm starting to bring some reality there to you.
Oh, no. And it came, Mackie? Come on now. What the?
Well, they could be implemented in different ways, but I think it would be cool if they kind of, I mean, now you get experience points towards the great general, and just use that, and then have a different kind of bonus based on it. I mean, you have a lot of experience. You don't only get the great generals, which can help you in various ways, you get some kind of passive bonus as well.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Podcast and Roughcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
So, anyway, this has been Polycast episode 120. I'm Stendhal McAlloy. With me, as usual, is Dan Quick.
Yeah! Woo! I spent 5 seconds thinking about what I was going to say, so...
Wow.
Yeah, you really put a lot of thought into that. with our guest, R101.
Thanks for having me here, and I'll see you next time, hopefully.
And Rob Stackney?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. In another life, I am the host of Three Moves Ahead, a weekly strategy game discussion with writers and game industry professionals. We focus on a single topic each week and cover new releases, analyze strategy classics, and debate issues in game design. I was really nervous about coming on the show, actually, when I saw the topic list, because when you cover all strategy games, you don't really get to spend a lot of time looking at one and getting really deep into it. And I was totally terrified I was going to have some sort of, like, Miss South Carolina moment on the show where you guys were discussing civilization at a completely different level than I'm capable of following. And I'd be like, I like wonders. I'm relieved that I did not fireball that badly.
All South Carolina residents for email. You want to send it to me?
And John Thompson.
Hey, folks. It's always fun talking with you guys.
And the broadcast is like over.
All right,
so awesome. Dan's like, and I'm out of here.
All right, thanks, guys. It was a blast.
Record date, June 11th, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Soundtracks copyright Take 2 Interactive.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.